we know put our extreme storytelling into superheroes and fantasy movies. That's one of the reasons they've dominated the last 10 years, which they have, really. And I think because the regular movies, we've lost the ability to tell extreme stories within more regular conventional movies, like realistic movies, if you like. And because of our society, because we've rounded off the edges of our society, we're in a kind of comfort zone, health and safety, but political correctness, all those kind of things. So you reduce the scope for realistic storytelling, I think. And obviously you go to Mumbai in India and it's all those edges are still there, very much so, and you can fall off them very easily and clamber up. And but it's the overall vivaciousness of the storytelling, I think, that is really Dickensian. I mean, there's obvious things that connect with it. Like, there's a theme running through it of father figures. People who are apparently are your friend, and actually they turn out not to be, and that's an absolutely straight out of Dickens, that. The person who rescues you, and then actually turns out to exploit you, you know?
So I love the word vivacious. That's very appropriate.
It is, I think, for it. And you read his stuff, and it's got that drive and popularity, and also he doesn't stint... Dickens, sometimes he gives it to you tough and then he gives it to you sweet, and again it's those extremes, tough, sweet, you know.
In your construction though, vivacious does mean relentless assaults of violence, cruelty, horror, in a way. Poor kid, I mean, the sense you get of 80s India, 90s, is quite like complete envelopment in lack of hygiene, garbage, the whole thing.
I mean, that's still there, really, because they don't. I mean, it's a disgrace, really. They don't. It's this country is an extraordinary country, and it's the fourth or fifth, sixth nuclear power in the world, but they don't have sufficient public toilets for people. I mean, you read about it when you're there. People can, people running campaigns to try and force the government to actually put in proper infrastructure like that, you know. And obviously they're going to have to do it. They will deal with it at some point, I guess, but not yet anyway. So that's still there. So that's easy to. It's not a question of recreating a period. It's still there. You just emphasise something.
You found a lot of that garbage in the water when you were shooting the younger kid sequences.
Yeah.
That was just there.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, we didn't put anything there. It's all.
Why have this
when he drops into the shit, obviously the bit that he drops into, that's not real shit, obviously, because he'd be made appallingly ill, and he'd probably die actually. Yeah. But so that's fake. But there is real stuff all around. Yeah, of course. And you have to protect him from it. You have to make sure it's ring fenced so that none of the real stuff gets in. Because it's peanut butter and chocolate, the stuff he drops in. It's a massive job, actually. What they have to do is drop a cylinder into it and then fill it and then make sure none of the real stuff gets in. It's massive, anyway.
I guess I had this idea that since the economy began to seriously boom, which began, in the mid-90s, maybe?
Yeah, the government, which is... It's a weird government because they had quite a close relationship with Russia. And they had a lot of communist-style restrictions on private enterprise, and particularly foreign investment.
Communist-style?
In the sense that they're not it's not a communist nation, but they did have quite a close relationship with Russia for a while, and a kind of sort of socialism, but socialism. India is much bigger than isms. It's just like, it sort of outgrows them very quickly. And so the government withdrew those restrictions and capital began to come in. And what's happened is you see this explosion, which now leads to them, the yearly growth is 9-10% in the economy and it's exploding. And you can see this growth of the middle classes, which is going to drive the economy. Now, previously in India, they really didn't have that middle group as a powerful group. They basically had a massive population and an incredibly rich sort of nobility, if you like, the equivalent of the nobility. Now, it's the middle class is growing. And some people say the middle class... They say the middle class is equal to the population of France, just middle class people. Some people say the middle class will very soon be the same as the whole population of North America. I.e. there'll be 300 million middle-class people with
Comparable lifestyle, you mean?
Yeah, and looking for that comparable lifestyle, demanding cars, cinema, activities, all the things that they're going to relax with after they've driven the economy during the day.
Sure.
And that's going to see enormous growth, huge problems in terms of resources and recycling and the planet, but also amazing for the country as well, you know.
How much had you...
Because also they speak English. That middle class will speak English.
Sure.
So in terms of movies,
right.
You can see, it's no wonder whether the studios are there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not fools. They can see, they're not sure whether it'll work or not, whether it is going to, whether there is going to be a hybrid, a union of the two forces of Hollywood and Bollywood.
Yeah.
But you can see, if there is, we better be there and be ready for it, you know?
Are you a Bollywood fan?
I enjoyed being there and watching. It helps to be there to watch the movies, without a doubt, obviously. It's bound to, isn't it? Because suddenly they're not exotic. Suddenly they're every day, you know. And I enjoyed watching them. There's this real vivacity in it. And I like how extreme it is, especially the music. And I love how much the music is mixed to the front. I don't just mean song and dance music. I mean, like, music that accompanies scenes is, like...
Right.
Slightly, it's much more hysterical than we have it. They don't hide the music, they declare it. I love that. And but there are some very good filmmakers there who are telling straight stories, you know, without song and dance. And that is growing.
The old-fashioned Sajid Ray way, you mean?
No, in a kind of more, in a modern kind
Danny Boyle way,
thrillerish. Yeah, if you like, yeah. I mean, in that kind of way, yeah.
Yeah.
I met a couple of, I saw some amazing films, actually. An amazing film called Satya, which means truth, S-A-T-Y-A, which is as good a film as I've seen. I mean, it's an excellent
film.
It's
not here, is it?
Hmm?
It's not playing.
No, it's about 4 or 5 years old.
Oh.
And it never really made much impact in the West, but it should have done. And there's another one called Company, which is an excellent film. These are thrillers, Company, as in Company. And another one, Black Friday, which is about the bombs in Mumbai, made by a very talented filmmaker, Anurag Kashyap, he's called. And these are really talented filmmakers, and they are making films that will appeal to that middle class that's growing, you know. So it's a really interesting time for them, you know.
I've tried to watch some Bollywood stuff, I mean, obviously, but I'm not a fan of it. I find it, like, I feel drenched in it within 5 minutes, you know.
It's like ladled on, isn't it?
However, your decision to end your film with that dance sequence was... beyond inspired.
Oh, cool. Oh, very good.
I mean, it's already... I mean, it's, the payoff is magnificent, the last 25 minutes, half hour. What is it? When does it start to, like... You start to really feel the moment. Okay, this is turning,
and then
maybe the last half hour. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But that was absolutely inspired. That was most...
You can't be there. Well, yeah. I mean, we were there... I was there for, like, 6-8 months altogether in total. You can't leave Bombay without a dance. You cannot. It would be so wrong to do that. It would. You might not have noticed it, but it would have actually been wrong not to have done, not to have left that. Because everybody, like, just to give an example, my driver, all the time I was there, was this lovely young guy called Harish, and he didn't speak any English, very little English. But we got on great, and we got on most. He would play music all the time. So he gets the CDs of the movies about a month before they come out, so that he can learn all the songs. So that when the songs come in the film, he can sing along to them, you know? So it's very different the way they approach, the way they approach stuff. It's really, and you've got to reflect that, I think, to have had any sense of having made an accurate or partially accurate picture, you know?
When did you, when was the first showings of this to anybody? When you finally had it done, before Telluride. I mean, when did somebody first really see it in a private format?
We did a couple of tests. I mean, a while back, we did a couple of test screenings in London. And I attended those test screenings, obviously, and I could tell then that it was going to work in the UK. But the UK has a much closer relationship with India, direct relationship with India, you know? And so I wasn't as confident.
Not to mention the Indian population, of course.
The Indian population,
right.
Our colonial role there, which we only abandoned 60 years ago.
Sure.
The history of television in the last 30 years has been shocking, the way it is used. It's gradually been eradicated, thank God, but it's used racism as comedy. Absolutely embedded in us. Coons, Pakis, we call them, and terrible, figures of fun. It's reverted now, and in fact, the Indian population that now lives in Britain and those who have been born in Britain have become comedians themselves. Right. It's a rich source of proper comedy now, where they send themselves off if they're going to do
if
it. You know?
Racism is made fun of and part of the comedic strain in England, that means it's obviously acknowledged much more honestly than it is here.
Well, no, I wouldn't paint it like that.
No.
It's shocking what. I mean, it's gone now, it's vanished now, thank God. It's been legislated out. Thanks, James. Because it was absolutely appalling. When I look back about 30 years ago and I think what was on television, I mean, now you would just. It would be a shock across the nation if you showed some of it. And it was very interesting. My dad.
You're saying that racism is not there in the working classes? They don't have. Enormous.
Less so now. Less so. I'm not making like any
markedly.
Comments. Markedly less so. Yeah, absolutely. They don't. A good job has been done of educating people, and you have to educate people out of racism because it's a kind of cheap, easy default setting that people rely on, especially in times of panic or worry. You know, the easiest way out is to blame somebody who feels a bit different. You know, rather than your own group. It's obvious, isn't it? Anyway, no. My dad was in India during the war. And he was waiting to invade Japan.
Hmm.
There was tens of thousands of men in Bombay being trained, ready to sail up to Japan and
right.
lose their lives, presumably
right.
a lot of them. Yeah. And then the bomb was dropped. And he's amazing. He said he was in Bombay when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And he knew, they all knew, those guys then, that they were not going to die. They were going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. Like a few weeks later, they just sailed home.
Right.
And that was it. It was all over.
Right.
So when he used to see this stuff on television in the 70s in the UK, he used to be so angry about the way it was portrayed, you know? Thank you very much. He was so angry about the way they were portrayed because he thought they were very decent people, very clean,
right.
decent
right.
people, and they were portrayed as being, you know? Anyway,
yeah.
So, sorry, I don't know how we got on.
Well, we were just having this conversation that that the mainstream media here, there is an understanding, and I think they don't serve the cause of journalism, truth, they don't serve the public, but they do not and will not acknowledge in this country, except once every 3 or 4 weeks, every now and then you hear somebody mention it.
Yeah.
Is race a factor in Barack Obama's ratings?
Yeah, sure.
And they go, maybe a little tiny bit in the fringes, you know. Bullshit. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the reason it's tight is because of racial alienation, animus,
yeah.
whatever you want to call it. But I just love the your progressive, matter-of-fact way. It is simply a matter of educating people out of it. It's simply a matter of, you know, I mean, it doesn't have to fester. It doesn't have to grow.
Education. My kids, I'm racist.
How many kids do you have?
I've got 3 kids. I'm racist. When I went to India, I was aware of it. You can feel it there. It's just there.
Right.
And you try and damp it down, but it's there.
Yeah.
My kids have been to proper schools where they've been taught properly, and right-wingers would say they'd had a terrible PC education, a politically correct education, and they despise it. But actually, it's a brilliant education because my kids are genuinely not racist. They don't see people as, they don't see themselves as being superior to other people simply because of they look different or they feel different.
Seems like almost all under 30, certainly the under 25s, I just don't get that at all. None of them are ever touch that sensibility, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah, they've kind of...
You know,
it's wonderful. It's progress.
Right.
It's
right.
great.
Right. Altogether.
Yeah.
From the first spark of, you know, well, this is what you wanted to do to today.
Hmm.
This is about a 2-year journey?
No, really. We sort of, from going there, we started filming in November of last year.
Uh-huh.
So we were working on and off in India from June. Sort of, I mean, we did the script, we were working on the script a bit before that, but proper visits to India and proper kind of setting it stuff. So it's about 18 months, I guess, April, May, June, we sort of went there, and then we settled in permanently from about July. So.
This is my ignorance. Sorry, I didn't have a chance to check the notes. But the actress, the drop dead, get down your knees, beautiful actress.
Yeah, Frida
works a lot in Indian cinema.
No,
no, she doesn't.
No,
you found her.
Yeah,
shit.
Yeah, she's
general casting call, or
yeah. She was The taste in Hollywood is in Bollywood, sorry, is very different for both our leads, both the boy and the girl.
Uh-huh.
The boy, and this was the reason he eventually came from London. Dev is where we brought him from, because all the young guys in Bollywood who were his age or a bit older, they're all built like muscles. It's all gym. It's all that uh-huh. look, that action hero look.
Uh-huh.
And I'd meet them, and they'd walk in, and they'd have these beautiful faces. And very intelligent, good actors, and they'd have this body grafted onto them where they couldn't even lower their arms. You know that look? When they sit and it's like that, and they move around and it's like this, because they've got chiplets.
Yeah.
And they can't, they have to be like that, because out there, that's what you get your work. You have to look like that. And conversely, the girl, you have to be much more voluptuous, much more curvy, if you like. So they're both, in a funny kind of way, are not quite the Bollywood look.
She struck me as nicely proportional, but you're saying she's not busty and not a big enough ass, is what you're saying.
Those kind of things.
Okay.
Really, I wouldn't dare say them on camera, but
yeah. So, the one thing that I know that this is a decision to kind of intensify the suspense, but the young actor, but. I'm sorry, can you please repeat his name?
Yeah, Jamal, or Dev Patel.
Right, Jamal's character. Many times when he is asked a question, he hesitates and stares as if thinking.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, he doesn't look like he's lost, but he does this delay thing.
Yeah.
Which obviously you're telling him to do. My experience with bright people is that they don't delay. They just know what they're doing, you know.
Yeah.
So why'd you tell them that delay thing? That's just what I'm... It's obviously, I respect your decision. I'm just saying, you know.
Because obviously when you record the show, the show's function in terms of the overall film, it has a function. But what you do when you record it, you have to do it as though it's absolutely happening live.
Mm-hmm.
What he's doing on the delay is he can't believe, as you wouldn't, he cannot believe that he's been asked this question. It's like... I mean, it's almost like, imagine it, if you went on a show like that and they started to ask you questions directly about your life, it would be like, hang on a minute, because you're expecting a question that has nothing to do with you, you know nothing about, it's like nuclear physics, you're asking a question about atoms, and you're like, that's what you're expecting, and you're going to have to guess. But they're asking questions, and that's why he goes into that kind of state, and equally, the other guy... The chat show host, which we don't see as much of. I mean, we did shoot it. We used a little bit of it. He can't believe the guy's getting the questions. He thinks there's no way he can get that question. So they've both got this kind of like suspension thing, which is like, oh, what's going on here? And I like that because actually it isn't like that on the show. Because you don't get that... it's not a pause, but it's like a void... in a TV show, because they won't allow it, you know, it's because they've got to fill any void and keep it going in case anybody turns off. So I like that. And it was important to contradict the hypnotic effect the show has, because as a piece of television, and clearly it plays all over the world, it's hugely successful, and it is hypnotic. Once you start watching it, you can't get away from it. It's like a little drug, a little virus that seeps through you.
Mm.
And you've got to be very careful making a film that it doesn't take over the film. You can feel it stretch and kind of, you think, I'm going to cut the music here, and you're cutting it, sounds wrong, because you're expecting it to just go on, like a very sweet, nice sticky pudding feeling you're enjoying. Anyway.
The police, presumably, have the kind of impunity power that if they want to really sweat someone, slap them around simply because they feel they're lying on a TV show. It's not exactly a crime.
No,
but no, they have that power. That no question about that.
And I'll tell you, we can prove it. We had to tell the Indian government about that scene, and they said that's fine, but there must be nobody involved above the rank of inspector.
That's funny.
and seriously, if you any offence is bigger than a traffic offence, you've got a kind of good chance of being slapped about a bit. And we visited some police cells and you can see the equipment. It's just lying there. I mean, these are Western, like, the equivalent of Western journalists walking in on an arranged visit to see what police cells are like for reference from making a movie.
Right.
And these slappers are lying there, these long wooden, they're sort of half leather, half wood, and they snap the back of your legs with them. And they're just lying there. And you go, they're not ashamed of it, you know. So, there's also a great book, Maximum City by Suketu Mehta, an amazing book if you want to read any more about Mumbai. And that makes it absolutely clear that it's just an almost regular occurrence.
You know, wow.
And expected.
How old was Maximum City, the book?
It was about 3 or 4 years old. It was runner-up for the Pulitzer Prize. It's a young guy who, he was my Bible, making the film, my kind of reference Bible.
Okay.
He's 18 and he leaves Mumbai and goes to live in New York.
Mm.
And he starts a family and he goes back at 32 with his wife and his two young children to live in Bombay again. He's a journalist by that time. And he writes about it. It's an amazing perspective, of course, because he's completely imbued in the culture. Then he gets 12 years of education and work in New York, and then he goes back and sees what it feels like.
Wow.
And he talks about the torture that goes on. The regular, everyday torture of people, ordinary people, just to get... I mean, it's fairly low-key. They're not going to kill anybody with the electricity. Just like, they're going to buzz them, that's all.
Speaking of vivacious and extreme cinema, have you seen Catherine Bigelow's film?
I saw it, not last night, the night before. I enjoyed it very much.
I thought that was amazing.
I don't think you guys realise what a good filmmaker she is. You know?
I do.
You do, but you know what I mean by you guys. I meant America. I don't think America realizes what a talent she is.
Yeah.
I don't think realize what a talent she is. I told her. I saw her last night at that party. I said, "Why don't you come to Europe and make a movie? It would be a serious event, because like Cronenberg came to make a movie in London, and it's wonderful when you get a seriously good foreign filmmaker to come to your city and make a film." I don't think people realize what talent there is. I mean, set piece sequences she shoots, and what she made this film for, and you know, the money she made it for, and the idea of this woman heading up this basically American film crew in the Middle East at the time of the highest vulnerability and danger for them, making a movie about Iraq in the Middle East, not in the Mexican desert, you know. I just thought it was extraordinary.
The pacing, the cutting, and I you know, there's this fine line between, as you obviously know, between camera work that seems to dart and jiggle and too much,
and then
when it's too staid, it's boring. This is
perfectly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's wonderful sequences in it. I mean, I love that sequence at the beginning with the robot boat. I didn't realize you expect it to be, and it's bouncing around like this.
Right.
So I just thought that was really funny.
I thought
and
it was
tense, you know?
Yeah.
And then when he pulls up the wires and there's like, fucking, I thought it was amazing.
I made the analogy that it feels as thrilling as the James Cameron's Aliens, you know, because instead of the monsters leaping out at you, they're just waiting, you know, and either they'll blow up or they won't.
That scene with the guy with the phone? They say, put on the phone. Yeah. This tiny little object that we've all got suddenly becomes like a nuclear bomb's going to go off. It's the tension in that moment of, fuck, what's he doing with that? And it's like, the cutting's brilliant.
Yeah.
So,
this is the inside
party, right? Yeah, well, she was there at that thing last night. I just met her. I'd met her once before. And I told her, I said to her, look, Near Dark is like one of my favourite films of all time.
Is Peter still here, right?
No, he's gone back. He went back on, I think he went back yesterday morning,
Okay.
So he's gone back to headquarters.
So when are you going to come to the States to do the big relentless push for the film? When will that happen? Because it comes out in November, is that the idea?
It's meant to come out in Thanksgiving, so I guess they're just working out exactly how to do it, really.
Right.
So I guess, I mean, I'll come back whenever I have to. We're the last night of the London Film Festival, and so that's
October, of course. Right?
It's October 28th or October 30th, and that's our next big proper screening after Toronto. But they'll start rolling it out, you know, across film festivals. screenings across America, I guess, across North America. So, yeah, that would
be. Well, maybe we'll run into each other. I can do another movie or something.
That'd be cool. That'd be very nice. Thanks, Jeff.
Best thing you've done since Trainspotting.
Do you think?
In my opinion.
Right.
Not to diminish anything that came after before, I'm just saying it hit me better than as good as Trainspotting.
Oh, cool. Well, I loved making it. I mean, I had a kind of obsession with it in the way that I did with Trainspotting. I remember, there was two very similar feelings. I remember Trainspotting, when we finished filming, I hated my crew for stopping filming. Because with Trainspotting, it was like, well, that's it. Everybody left.
Oh, it's time for tea, or we're breaking now, and that's it.
They had to stop, because they weren't going to be paid anymore. There was no more money. And I remember thinking, I was like really mad at them for walking away from me, because I wanted to keep filming. And they had to drag me away from Bombay as well, because I'd have just kept going. Because I'd work on my days off. Well, I mean, directors always do, but I would schedule the second unit so it worked on a Sunday so I could go out shooting with them. And then if that didn't happen, I'd go out with the little camera and start to shoot myself. I just loved it. So I had that obsession with it, you know.
What did you shoot this with, by the way? This was shot with a red camera, wasn't it?
No. It was shot... It gives a similar result to a red camera. It's an alternative system called an SI2K.
Okay.
Silicon Imaging 2K camera. It's a prototype. It's really kind of... It was put together just for us. And it's not what you'd recognize as a proper camera. It's a computer and a little gyro with a camera lens kind of attached to it almost. It's so small. And it allows you to do very flexible shooting in running and things like that.
Are you actually capturing more of a 16:9 or a higher image, and then you're cropping it off in post?
Yeah, that's what we do.
Does that mean you're going to use, for those who don't like to see matted, you'll use the higher version or the fuller version?
I don't think, we used it, obviously. Sometimes you want to rack up and down within a picture for storytelling reasons. But I don't think that will ever be shown as such. I don't think so, no. We've no plans to, no.
Just some people have done that. I mean, I think it's so... Kubrick is a big guy. He didn't like to have the matting.
I know. And I think it is very interesting, especially when you think about... I mean, television's slightly changed now, the shape of televisions. But I can imagine Kubrick sitting at home, looking at television shapes and thinking, this is nuts, making films like this. Most people watch it like this, you know. And the square shape is also a very interesting aesthetic, really, to use.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
You know? So,
have you ever thought about shooting in black and white just to do it? Is that not vivacious and extreme enough?
I don't know why. There'd have to be a reason, really, to...
Because it's beautiful to look at?
It is beautiful to look at, but you've got to let the story always dictate technology. And I call black and white technology, really, because they're aesthetic choices about your technology, aren't they? And you've got to let the story dictate it. It's very bad, I think, if you come in going, I want to make a black and white movie. But if your story tells you it's black and white or tells you this, then you make it like that, right. I think. You know? That's always the way it should be, I think.
Writing anything, any story, screenplay, at some point, it starts telling you.
It starts making decisions for you.
Right.
That's the best way when that happens, isn't it?
Right.
You know you're on. It's sort of a weird thing that starts going on. You think, oh, right, okay.
Yep.
That seems right. Why would it not be like that? Yeah. I know.
I better get going.
Okay.
I have an 11 o'clock thing, actually.
Okay,
very, very nice.
Very nice to meet you, too.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Coming.
Thanks, Jeff. We'll see you again, yeah?
Be well, Dan.
Cheers, man.
Bye-bye.